Hello, listener. Before we get into this week's episode, a small confession. I cocked up my microphone for the first few minutes of this week's recording. So unfortunately, the quality of my voice isn't ideal. But bear with it. It does get much better, I think, about 5 minutes in. So apologies for that. But do listen on. This week is an absolute belter. Hello. And welcome to The Knot, a mindful motorcycle podcast. Have you set him up for this?
No.
You've been telling him?
No.
It's this awful,
myself now.
Yeah.
It's the presenter
talk about
voice
mindful, mindful podcast. You know, you should be mindful about your radio voice.
Here Hello we go. And welcome to The Nod, a mindful motorcycle podcast. One day we'll nail this and it'll be really sick.
You should put a hood over your head when you do it. Yeah, know. You know what I mean?
We're once again supported by our great friends and sponsors, the BMIC. The British Motorcycle Insurance Community is a new digital insurance-led community building platform for the UK's motorcycle brands, communities, associations and riders. The BMIC connects riders directly with a regulated, established insurer, eliminating intermediaries and pooling spending power to give back to its members in the form of lower premiums, better cover and rewards. Visit the BMIC to see how you and your motorcycle community can benefit. And still with us from last week.
I wasn't with you last week. It was just me and Charlie. We're out today. I'm over here as well.
You were with us last week and we thought we'd better not risk you disappearing off into the ether again. So we'll do another episode whilst we've got hold of you. So here we are back again in the Surrey Hills again. Similar format to last week. And once again, we've had a lovely day.
With the Nortons.
Hooray!
And we ran out of fuel again.
We did actually run out of fuel twice.
Two different bikes.
One for each episode.
So someone at Norton is going to get there.
I was just told that there was a scolding over the phone. Yeah. Putting petrol in the bikes.
Since last week, you know, we did the DGR, week we went to the bike shed show.
Yeah.
Which was a huge success.
Was it?
More people than we've ever had. Bigger than we ever had, more bikes than we've ever had, more food trucks than we've ever had, more bands, more bars, more everything, really, more cocktails.
Good times. And saw a lot of people, which was always nice, catching up with mates.
Yeah, no, it was
Callum
nice.
From Debolex, friend of the show, had some more of his number 25s out.
Always awesome.
God, they're just unbelievable.
You know what stole the show for me was Sticky Garage. Can't remember the name. That GSXR. GSXR with the fluorescent paint on it and the kind of white and that thing was just that stole the show for me.
There was a few nice bits and pieces and there was some just damn fine people around as well. And just so you know, I was down at Goodwood a couple of days ago at a racetrack. I just thought I want to get this out.
Lord March
invited us along. Well, they asked if you guys wanted to come and I said they probably don't. Because it wouldn't be their cars aren't your thing, are they? Motorbikes.
I did 5 years of a car TV show building cars.
You
built
motorbikes on that car show, didn't you?
I did, but I also built cars.
Anyway, so I went there and they do this track day where they invite all the manufacturers along, everyone you could possibly think of.
Except for me and Ben.
From McLaren to Mercedes to Ferrari to Rolls Royce to Toyota to everyone. And they get their supercars.
So were you driving around in a Yaris? Were you?
That Yaris four-wheel drive is just...
It is a bonkers little thing, isn't it?
It's incredible. It's a 1.8-litre massive turbo. It's basically, in order to do the IRC Rally or the World Rally Championships,
they have to
homologize. So it's basically that.
Group B, is that what they call it?
Group B car. And so I drove the McLaren F1, I drove the Aston Martin, Ferrari, the Yaris, and the one that I loved the most was the Rolls Royce.
Well, one of the big
which Rolls Royce was it?
The four-door one. I don't know the numbers.
The Phantom.
But in the corners, the Atom... passes on the corners and then going up the straights we were catching it and overtaking it on the straight in a Rolls Royce.
In a silent interior. Silent interior.
Silent interior. Rides on rails around the corner. It's extraordinary. And then you just back
off. You only do a lap in it.
And then you have to fill it up. No, it's really good. You can get up to 28 miles per gallon on this car. But then
not around the track.
But then you just sit on this beautiful, comfortable, incredible interior and you can just cruise at 20 miles an hour, which the whole of Britain is turning into.
Yeah. See, but the thing is, if you buy a Rolls Royce, you can't drive it yourself. You need to sit in the back seat.
Oh, no, you've got to drive it yourself. It's just... Anyway, what are you doing to go to changing nappies?
I had a barbecue delivered. Oh? It came in so many bits. It took me 2 hours to put the thing together.
Yeah, I put my sister's together. It was the same. We ordered it online and it showed up.
I bought a decent one and it came fully made.
Oh, this was a decent one as well, but it was a Weber and it came in bits.
Well, we digress.
We've had a lovely week. It's been a good week. Sun's been shining. I did a little bit of riding on my lovely Ducati Desert X.
I've got just 60 miles to go before
we had a nice ride together on ours because you've got one now because you copied me. You did a review in full. That's a good old bike. We had a lovely ride to the bike show back on ours, didn't we? That's just such fun bikes.
I've yet to have a go. Best bike I think I've ridden in about 11 years.
Yeah, we'll talk about the Nords in a second, but we'll bring in today's guest, because he's just sitting here. He's kind of already part of the show, but we'll actually introduce him, shall we?
It'd be a good idea, because it is about... the guests.
Yeah. Isn't it? I've gone to the effort of copy and pasting this off his agent's website.
It's here you go. This will be fun.
This week we're joined by Titch Cormack. Hi Titch.
Hey guys, all right.
How you going?
He is devilishly good looking. We've got to stop having such good looking people on the show.
I know.
Can we just get ugly people?
Must be difficult for you.
It's really difficult. Titch is a highly motivated and robust.
Yes.
Robust.
Oh, that's such a great way to describe someone. Robust.
Yeah, I mean, you can hit him with a bat.
That's a polite way of calling someone fat, right?
Robust. He's anything but fat. A robust UK Special Forces operator. Former, I think that should probably say. Titch has over 20 years' experience in conventional and covert operations, having joined the Royal Marines as a teenager. Titch left the forces in 2016, determined to combine the two things he loves, engineering and adventure. So built S-Bomb, a vintage workshop where he and his team build, transform, and customise bespoke motorcycles, as seen on BBC Two's The Speed Shop.
Yes!
God, you lucky, how you managed to get a TV show.
I have no idea.
BBC, the amount of times I've tried, I've just, motorcycle TV shows just doldrums.
I mean, we'll put you both together.
I've never been on television TV show.
Yeah, I mean... We started off by saying how good looking he was. That probably helps. Yeah. The screen test next to you.
That's true. Well, I before I was chubby, I used to be, relatively. Actually, before my surgery, I was.
how does that translate in English?
I don't know what that means, but it sounds like so creepy. But we're going to leave that in. Described as a souped up man cave.
It's got so many different connotations there.
Titch renovated the derelict workshop and turned it into a community space for coffee, beers, and mechanical magic. Exclamation mark.
It needs an exclamation mark, yeah. The amount of time it took me, it needs two exclamation marks.
Almost as long as it takes Ant to build a bike.
Exactly. Listen, again, perfection takes time. My clients don't mind.
Well, that's lucky. Alongside building and selling vintage motorcycles, Titch and the team also upcycle modern vintage furniture, pushing creations to the limit.
Yes, indeed.
God, this is good shit, isn't it?
Wow.
Born in Hull, raised in Grimsby.
Hey, my God.
That's not the profile, because that's
a great line.
Yeah, yeah.
Titch was born in Hull, raised in Grimsby, and made in the military.
Oh, I know this. Well, yes.
I think he wrote that. In the military. That was his line.
I think this was actually off the first little YouTube film that was done.
Was it?
But
was complete when he retired and built the S-Bomb, where he now spends most of his days.
Well, it's like writing.
crying, thinking, what can I do next?
And this bit about, here we go. Passion for bikes, avid expedition rider and racer, You raced for the Royal Navy Royal Marines road race team.
I did.
God, that's indeed a long sticker.
Yes, it's a very long sticker. The RNRMRMRT.
We're British and we like that. We like acronyms, don't we?
That's on your agent's website. That all seems to be true.
It is indeed all true. Yeah, all of it. Obviously, you went into the military early, so you knew you wanted to do that. Did you ride motorbikes?
I didn't.
Before that?
No, I didn't.
So how did you join the military? Because of your father or your background?
Exactly. Yeah, you're hitting the nail on that there, Charlie. It was, I don't mind telling the story, really, is that I wanted to impress my dad, really. So my grandfather was a Royal Marine. And he landed at D-Day. In fact, we featured it on episode 3 or 4 of Speed Shop. Yeah, he landed on Sword Beach and he was a Royal Marine. My dad's always spoken very highly of him. Unfortunately, he died the year I was born. So I never really met him, although in person we had been together. Well, there was always a strained relationship between my dad. And I thought the best policy for me to gain that kudos off the old man was to do what my grandfather did. Now, incidentally, I did pass my pilot's exams to go join the RAF as a pilot. They were going to put me through university. But I mugged that off because that's a fool's errand, isn't it? What you need to do is join the Marines.
Spend your 18th birthday in
the sky. Who wants to fly
helicopters anyway?
You can live in a trench.
Yeah exactly. So wisely, I then joined the Royal Marines. And it did exactly what I wanted it to do. You know, when I eventually passed out of Royal Marines training, my relationship with my dad changed massively, which was great.
Was your father in the military as well?
No, but dad was a teacher. So,
okay.
Yeah. So it worked really, really well in my mind. But to be fair, that reasoning behind joining pales in insignificance, really, really, for what I did while I was in there, because I loved it. And if given the choice again, I would do exactly the same. Yeah.
What was it you loved about it?
The camaraderie of it. You know, I will never meet any people in my life that I've spent so many, dare I say, intimate times with, in a way that we are living out of each other's pockets all the time. You know, we are in it thick and thin, and you build amazing relationships with these guys. You know, they were my best mates. I still talk to all of those guys now that I was in my first unit with, which was 4-5 Commando up in Scotland, which is fantastic. And certainly when I then progressed on even further and went down and joined the SBS, then those guys, and we went through all sorts together, yeah.
See, I always fancied joining the military when I was younger, but I have
this. Was that when you were playing with Action Man?
Yeah, exactly.
With the rubber gloves, with rubber grips.
I thought a lot of my friends joined the Army and the military and the Navy and stuff when we were 16, 17, 18.
Being arrested. And,
well, yeah, of course.
You were told and you go
I
to
thought, okay, if I fail military. In everything else, then my backup is going to the military. But I've always had this weird problem with authorities ever since I was a kid. And I've just thought, if I have to wake up at 6 a.m. and someone's telling me to get out of bed, I'm going to tell them to go fuck themselves. And they'll kick me out of the Army
and not be there, really.
It's a wise choice.
So the SBS, and that obviously is a huge thing to decide to go and do, because that's special training. It's really difficult to be selected for that. So why did you decide to go down that route?
I'd sort of put it off because there was lots of things that transpired in between that. I actually left the Marines at one point because I'd punctured my lung. I fell off a building at my mate's wedding, of all things.
Fell off a building at a mate's wedding.
Yeah.
I broke my elbow.
Amazing. I was at Phil Durrell's wedding. Hey, Phil, if you're listening. He was in Edinburgh. Beautiful military wedding up in the castle. And then afterwards, we were all in full blues. We went back to the hotel to get changed out into our civilian clothing for the night do. I'd lost the key for my hotel. What's the best thing to do? Not go to the reception.
No,
that's my window for my hotel room. I know that. And I'm going to climb up there because I can.
How many pints at this point?
Fair few.
Yeah.
Enough to think that was the best idea.
He's standing on the ground.
Yeah.
There's the reception
door.
There's
reception.
And key. There's the window
there's
up there.
There's the window. No, we'll do this. So I climbed up to the front of the building, and it was like these big stone slabs. So it was actually quite an easy climb. However, the windowsill was slate, and it'd been raining. And I put my hands on the windowsill, and they just slipped straight off. And straight down below me, there's a cellar, and then the metal railings around the thing. And I kicked off the wall to try and clear the cellar and came down on the metal railings.
Well, you got stabbed in.
Yeah, so I was such a slim little individual then. I had one come in front of me and one stuck in my back.
Jesus.
Broke my ribs and I was hung off the railings.
Jesus. Isn't it funny the things we do that when we're pissed? Because a couple of Christmases ago, I somehow managed to find my way home in terrible pain. And I'd left the pub on Christmas Eve with my children saying, please don't take the electric stand-up scooter home. And I said, fuck you.
Yeah,
and no. I got on the thing. And then apparently I went round the corner, misjudged the corner, hit a parked Aston Martin.
Found a cheap car to hit the side
of my ribs, broke every single rib on this side and collapsed and punctured and my lung filled up with blood. And
Particularly unpleasant.
It's not very nice, is it?
No, really? No. And they stick that thing in your thing
to drain all this shit out.
Yeah, that's right.
That sounds like a little bit worse than
impaled on a fence.
Yeah, that's nothing.
That's nothing. You know,
had I hit a Toyota or another car, I'd have been fine.
It would have been half the story.
It was an Aston.
It was like hitting a brick wall.
So this had happened, and the story goes on, because I was with a friend. He pulled me off the railings. I was pretty sober at this point. You know, you sober up fairly quickly. He was still very drunk. And he says to me, we'll sleep here and it'll all be all right in the morning. At which point I'm trying to say ambulance because your lungs are filling with blood. I was bleeding out the mouth. And at one point he obviously realised there's something wrong, so he phoned a taxi. The taxi turned up, saw what was going on, immediately phoned an ambulance. Ambulance rocks up, they get me, put me into the ambulance, and Shane comes with me. This is my mate. And then the next bit of the story I get from my mum, because my mum's there asleep at 3 a.m. or whatever it was by the time they got there. The phone starts ringing, she answered the phone, and the nurses had said, do you know his next of kin? And Shane had stayed at my house in Grimsby several times, knew my mum. So they gave they rang next of kin and rang my mum and gave the phone to Shane. Pat, it's Shane. Yeah, what is it? It's Titch. He's probably dead. This is what he said. He's probably dead. At which point, the nurse takes the phone off Shane and is like, Mrs. Crawford's got, he is not dead. He has gone into emergency surgery. As much as I find it funny now, I bet my mum absolutely dropped a brick with
that. What is he thinking? He's probably dead.
I mean, God.
Was he drunk as well?
Oh, yeah, he was absolutely smashed. Yeah.
So then you got better.
Yeah, and then I applied to go for Special Forces selection. And at the time, SBS and SAS were separate. So they did separate selections, and I couldn't go SBS selection because I got a punctured lung. Because you got a bit of a dive and all that sort of stuff. So I put in for SAS, and there was a waiting list. And I was like, I'm not waiting 4 years. I then went through a mate of mine who had connections in DSF, Director of Special Forces, with the Australian SAS, and applied to go to Australia. So I went for that, put in my chit to leave the Marines, which I did. However, it all fell through because my medical history went missing.
Conveniently.
So I then applied for the paras. For selection for the parachute regiment, and they have a little pre-course to go parachute regiment. Went down for that. One of the guy running it had been on my JWIs, jungle warfare instructors, so he knew me and he was like, what are you doing down here? I'm joining the para reg. So I did that, passed that, and then I was supposed to be joining the depot for training on the Tuesday, and I played football for my local football team on the Sunday, and that's when I snapped my ACL. Somebody tackled me, put a foot straight in my knee, snapped my knee. Turned up to depot for a parachute regiment training. No, you can't do that. So then I had to get all that repaired, and then I went tail between my legs back to the Marines. Can I rejoin the Marines? Which they allowed me to do. Rejoined the Marines, and then I did Iraq 2003 with 40 Commando, and then put in for selection for SBS, because by that time, the SBS and SAS training had joined together. It was joint selection then, and went straight through. You did ask how selection was, Charlie. It was fucking atrocious, mate. It's not meant to be pleasant. It's absolutely horrific. But in a weird, sadistic way, I enjoyed it. Yeah.
Was that a sense of achievement?
It was really interesting. It's a really interesting process. I can chat about the process is easily found online, so it's not a problem chatting about it. But certainly the initial block of it, which is the Hills phase, is purely a physical test. They are getting rid of all the chaff. And the final tests at the end, the test matches, as they call them, are pretty full on. I think we're carrying 75 pounds. You've got 19 hours to do it in, and it's something like 45 miles, 47 miles, something like that. 47 miles, and it's not just like running on a treadmill.
And you can't get caught either, is it?
That's after that. And they pick every huge feature in Wales for you to go up and down and then back up again and down.
In the middle of winter.
But you'll come to the end of that. Then the jungle. Now, that's the real tester, to be fair, the jungle. The jungle's where they really look at you. That's when they stop looking at you. That's just a physical test. Whoever's there at the end, then they start looking at you. Yeah, what are you capable of doing? Let's start boring down into you as a person. Let's see if we can crack you and find your weaknesses. I've never done soldiering like it in my life. It was amazing. And from there, that's when you go to R2I, so resistance to interrogation, escape and evasion and stuff.
I've done that.
Yeah.
Anywhere near in your
session, isn't it? You learn a lot about yourself in these
situations. I did three days prep for a TV show.
I spent a week at CTCRM.
Oh, did you?
Yeah, as a cadet.
More acronyms.
Yeah, I was in the cadets.
Yeah. Did you go the Tarzan Salt course and all that?
No, they wouldn't let us loose on the full time because we were like 15, 16. I wasn't even old enough to be there, but lied about my age to get on the course. It's part of my gold D of E residential.
I joined the Beavers when I was a kid.
The Beavers? It's
very similar to Selection, I believe.
As a kid?
Yeah. Brutal.
We had a vest.
Amazing. Do you have a woggle?
We had one of them. The yellow one.
So this... All of that, obviously, Selection came at the end of quite a period of adversity for you. I guess the first question is, during Selection, do you have time to process or observe and learn? Because they're pushing you to find out stuff about you that you might not know yourself. Do you have the time and headspace to be sort of introspective about that learning as you go and what you're actually made of, or is it too intense?
It's a bit too intense to really you're concentrating purely on achieving what they require, and one of the aspects that they're looking at is that you can assimilate information quickly and act on it, and you've got to be able to learn quickly and act on it because things change all the time, and you've got to be able to do that. If you're somebody that can't really, it takes you a while to get into a routine or learn a skill set, then they're not interested. You need to be able to do it quickly and stuff like that.
I find chaos quite good. I really enjoy it. It's weird, you know, with the,
you would have easily made Selection. You know, if you'd put your mind to it, you know, that calmness.
I think I probably would have.
You know, you could have probably set fuses and bombs and got your guns going out. And
is there an age limit on the Canadian Special Forces? Do you think it's too late?
No, I don't think there is.
So is that ever too late?
Yeah.
Can a 47-year-old join the Special Forces?
So how long were you in SPS
10 years.
For? Wow.
So I did all sorts of work in there. And initially, I joined one of the squadrons. And then after several tours, did a lot of work in Afghanistan and stuff like that. And then I went and worked with a little specialist unit for a while and then came back. But all this time, I've been riding motorcycles.
So was that part of the job? Because I've spoken to mates Foxy and guys. Do you ride bikes? And he's like, oh, no, we're kind of road quads and stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think Ollerton rode some bikes out there. The description of the bikes you guys got to ride, it wasn't great.
The old military bikes were these old Harley Davidsons, which had horrific suspension on them.
Were they the Rotax bikes?
Yeah,
they
were Rotax.
The Rotax ones.
So those were originally the military bikes. And then they moved out, certainly in the SF world, they moved to XR400s, which are... I love them.
Really nice bike.
They're bomb.
Yeah, I've got two of them myself.
Because I did with Simon Pavey down in Wales in the Wofford School. We did a bunch of courses with some of the Special Forces guys to go forward and get better on the bikes because they're great for reconnaissance, aren't they?
Absolutely.
You can drive along, chuck them in the bush.
We use them for all sorts of things. Yeah. They're very manoeuvrable. You can turn them around easy. When you're leaning, if you had a big convoy of large vehicles and they all of a sudden get backed up in a waddy system or something like that, you've got a problem. So send off your guys. Now, subsequently, I would imagine
they're using a lot of
been replaced by drones. That's certainly the way ahead, and not just for the eco side of it's because of the noise signature.
It's an area of just
because if you're riding into enemy territory on a dirt bike, you're like, you can hear them coming miles away.
The ones we were using, ended up using Yamahas, and they were great, but they were like sedated right down. Yeah,
so just part of your job, you're talking very technically about. So you, within your role, it wasn't just get a bike, learn to ride it, and go and work. No. It was like, how what can we do? It was the maintenance, the management, the customization of those bikes, so they were fit for purpose for your
absolutely.
Work.
You had to fix them on the fly.
And that was the great thing about the XRs. It's such a brilliant sewing machine engine, isn't it? And they're just super simple, fix it, easy, not a problem at all.
And you get parts in.
Yeah. So they were a brilliant bit of kit, and we used those, and then subsequently we went on to the Yamahas. My sort of speciality was doing mobility operations. So as much as I was SBS, I very rarely in the water. Very rarely. I was all land-based ops. Mm. So everything I did was on land. I ended up going as becoming the chief instructor for mobility throughout the service. So that was like, they were just like a round peg, round hole. Send Titch in there.
Is that a normal thing to last 10 years in SBS?
Yeah. There's guys that go further on, know. But inevitably, you do come away from the active side of things. Then you've got to realise that, you know, there's younger, fitter, faster boys than you coming through. It's their time now. It's their time to do all the fun stuff.
Fun
stuff, yeah.
Interesting phrase, isn't it?
Yeah. The fun stuff.
Yeah. So, I guess it was fun. Otherwise, you wouldn't do it.
Well, this is it. You know, like you described, actually, Ant, was enjoying the chaos. Probably one of the most amazing things I've been involved with. We were in a job quite close to the Pakistan border, but it's the closest thing I could imagine to being to World War II I've ever experienced in my life. It was bizarre. We were using tanks, walking in behind tanks, and it was all going off. At one point, there was a bulldozer, so a huge bulldozer. They had obviously gone over an oil barrel, and it had caught fire. But these things are all armoured up, didn't affect it. And the guy was just cracking on. There's a bulldozer on fire, just cracking on down the road. And we're like, this is bananas, do you know what I mean? Like, what? We were taking constant fire. We had AC-130 up ahead, putting down rounds, Warthogs, A-10 gunships. But everything's going off, and it's a 360 battle. You're not talking just guys in front of you in a line. They're behind you. They're ahead of you. They're in tunnels under the ground. It's everywhere.
See, I think if I could have got past the belligerent me not wanting the authority thing, I think I probably would have done well through that. Because
he's really talking himself into a career in the military.
No, but I'm just saying, not many people would say they would enjoy getting shot at. But that kind of turns me on a little bit. I like that chaos of like. Well, you know what I mean, like of the madness of it. You know what I mean, like
how many of those Jack Daniels have you had?
This is my second Jack Daniels, all right. And they're very small Jack Daniels.
Talking going
your
on
life there. Is chaotic in itself without throwing military.
Well, I think that's what I'm looking for, to fill that void of chaos.
So then, what did they suggest you leave, or did you decide you've had enough?
I was medically discharged in the end. Multiple injuries. My legs are all held. We got pins, plates, screws in my legs and stuff for various accidents. I was in a parachute accident that smashed up my right leg. The left knee's been reconstructed 3 times. I've got no ligaments in there that are mine now, but I was discharged from the military still in a caliper and needing a knee reconstruction. But this was not to do with the SBS. This was to do with the Navy. The Navy buggered up the paperwork and discharged me from the military, still needing surgery, which I was booked in to have. My guys, my head shed, went back to them and said, hang on a minute, this guy needs fixing. You can't just kick him out. And after a lot of to-ing and fro-ing, the Navy's response was, he was medically discharged back in April. He's not our responsibility anymore. So to end 21 years service on that now was a kick in the balls.
What was that period like? Was it? Did you have a focus, or were you just?
I did. I knew what I wanted to do.
Okay.
You know, I was towards the end of my career anyway when I got medical discharge. So I knew that what I wanted to do was change my passion, which was the motorcycles, and turn it into a living.
You didn't do any research then?
No, absolutely nothing. There's no business. No bikes. Yeah, no, I've got no idea what I'm doing. It just seems like a good idea.
Have you spoken to anybody that tried it before?
Not at all.
Like, don't.
And then it doesn't mean, because I look back on my stuff, because I was doing a little video log of me when I first got the place that was going to turn into what is now the S-bomb. And I think my first initial one was like, look, this is the building, walked around it and said, look, okay, I'm going to give myself a limit of 6 weeks to turn this around. I do not know what I was thinking. 8 months later.
Is that because you were used to having a whole British army behind you?
I think that's what it was. And to be fair, the lads were great, because the lads in their time off were coming and helping me and stuff like that, you know.
How did you end up getting the TV gig?
The TV show. Well, there was this little film that we did for YouTube. So this was out there, and I think it got shared in the circles of like Foxy and some of the other guys who were out there. and they'd sort of shared it about, and it had gone into that world then. And another guy, Gaz, had been working with a guy called Grant Wardrop, who had a production company, and said, "Oh, look at this. This is one of our guys doing this." So I just got a message on Facebook. "Would you be interested in doing a TV show?" And I was like, "Yeah." Not one to turn anything down, to be fair. I'm like, "No, why not?" And he came down, and we had a good chat, put a little 10-minute film together that got sent off to the BBC, and they commissioned then a pilot, broadcastable pilot, where we took a guy called Chris Duggan, missing a leg, yeah, a parachute regiment guy, built a bike for him, and we took the Hannibal route, or as close as we could get to the Hannibal route across from France into Italy, which was brilliant. It was fantastic to do that, you know. And Chris, off the back of that, as much as he was very wobbly on the bike when we took him out there, it was quite concerning, to be fair. He's recovered a lot, and he's back onto riding the bikes, and he got a ride for True Heroes Race Team, the military
they're putting
him through their race school. I think he's got about 2 years of constant training, and then he can go out and ride BSB, which for him was amazing, because that guy was at a real low point, you know what I mean? He'd lost his leg, and he needed something. That impetus to go and do that was fantastic for him. So that's a real success story in my book.
Yeah. There's a friend of mine, Ben, his son, Noah, was an up-and-coming motocross MX rider, built his own ramp in his back garden, 30-foot ramp, and was just like progressing amazingly, and then had a training crash at home and broke his back and paralysed. But he's on another one of these motorsport pathways for disabled people, and he's just taken part in his first 24-hour race. He can't ride bikes at the moment because he doesn't have the core strength, but he's racing cars. So
I think with
his passion and his
ability is still there. It's just that it's been limited in some...
I mean, when I smashed my legs up in this motorcycle crash, and I did 27 operations and 2 years to walk again and all that bollocks, that I was the first person ever to break...
The Tiger
1200, when broke it to three pieces, I was the first person ever.
Was this with your own legs?
Probably. Yeah.
Well, my legs. That only went into three pieces. Your legs are in about 12.
I'm riding a Triumph Tiger in Spain.
But only the 900s. It's fine. Yeah. But my whole rehab was focused on getting back on the motorcycle. And I think, you know, your friend, and it's lovely to hear. Yeah. That kind of so, and then I suppose your connection with the military will always be strong, I'm guessing.
Yeah. Oh, certainly. I mean, there's some brilliant examples of exactly this. Is with Billy. So Billy rides with one hand. Mm. You know, he velcros himself on with that hand, and they were going to cut his arm off, and he said, "Well, actually, I want to keep it," because he could move his shoulder. And the only reason he kept it was because he knew if he splinted his arm, he could put some input into the bars of a motorcycle. To the point he managed to finish Western Beach Race, which was just
brutal.
Amazing.
Most people who have all four limbs can't do Western Beach Race.
So yeah, he velcros himself on, splints his arm, and he can push his shoulder backwards and forwards so he can put some input into the bar.
And that was purely
so he could ride the bike.
It's amazing. Yeah.
We took a guy on our motorcycle tour in Africa. He was missing his left hand. We did the same thing. Got a ball, and he had that bit of pad with his fingers and everything gone, just as you said, Velcro. And he was brilliant. It just took minutes to get
his head around it and riding. It's amazing what you can achieve. And again, we did that one trip where we took the guys across Morocco. We had multiple various injuries there, and we modified vehicles and bikes for them all to go across there. And the biggest successful there we had was with Lamin, who's a triple amputee, he's got one arm. And he was driving a vehicle with Spence, who is an officer who's now got multiple sclerosis and hasn't got the use of his legs. So between them, they had three working limbs between them, and we set them up in a side-by-side buggy with one of the steering knobs on the wheel so they could steer, and then the passenger did accelerating and brake, and they drove all the way through Morocco and just kept flip-flacking because Lamin could do it with one arm. So there they were with three working limbs between them, all the way through Morocco.
I used to go to this event in Biarritz every year, Wheels and Waves. And one year I was driving from, I was in England at the time. I drove out to, on my way to Biarritz. And it's the same weekend as Le Mans. So I stopped at this petrol station and I could hear these guys laughing and talking beside the van. And I got up, and those guys, they had a big race truck, and they were all military guys. There's a British military team for amputees. They had this car all set up, and everything was all hand controls, and the steering wheel had everything. And we were having a chat about what happened and his accident and this and that. And this guy has fucking lost his legs. And I'm like, how the fuck would I deal with that? Like, I don't think I'd be as strong as this guy. He's like, gone on. He's lost his legs. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to carry on, move on. I'm going to do this.
But then once you've lost something, you don't really have a choice, either you sink or swim.
Think, like, I'd go into a deep, dark depression.
The sort of extreme case of it was obviously Toby, episode one. He was an SBS operator who was shot through the neck. Incidentally, he'd been shot previously on that tour. He'd already caught one up, got fixed, came back out, and I think it was his third job out the door. They breached into the compound. As he went through the breach hole, they sprayed machine gun fire, went straight through his neck, severed his spine, and he is now paralysed from the neck down. And I know it is not as easy as this front that he puts out there, that he's like, yeah, I'm cracking on. You know, this guy, imagine this, going from this, from the top of your game to all of a sudden being stuck in a chair for the rest of your life. That's it. And so difficult to get your head round how he has the motivation to push on.
Do you talk to him about that?
Yeah, talk to him about that. What? You know, I can tell when he's down in his wheel, though.
Because as strong as he is and what he's all gone through, he still has dark days,
oh,
I'm sure.
You know it's not. I can speak to Toby and Toby's like, yeah, mate, yeah, all good. And I know he's not.
Well, we all do that.
Don't bullshit me, mate. What's the score? And he was like, what the fuck? And let him get it all out. Which exactly what...
Well, that's just what you need
what
to do,
what a lot of this
it?
Is about. Do you know what I mean?
Exactly.
And the guys from my background, and a lot of the guys that you guys know, are very stubborn and in the fact that they will not talk about their issues. They will say, yeah, I'm fine. It's all good. It's all good. You know, and you know your mates. We've had 3 suicides from our service over the last few years, all of which the guys had no idea about. They were chatting away with the guys. They were very, very good at keeping it all closed doors and not...
But that's
part of your training.
But that's traditionally,
so that was the job, right? You can't compartmentalize all that stuff.
Absolutely. Train you very, very well to basically compartmentalize all the experience, all the stuff, and not allow any emotions through and just to carry on and do it.
Which is great for doing your job.
But up until recently, all men are taught
from the
beginning not to show it. And what's lovely now is that, and I see it a lot with my daughter's friends, the guys as well, they're happy to be open and they're happy to talk about it. And in that regard, they're in a much better shape. Whereas, you know, people who are sort of 30s, 40s plus.
If I showed emotion to my mates when I was 15, 16, 18, you know, they'd be like, stop being a pussy. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Did you have periods of time where it didn't go so well for you?
But inevitably in anybody's life, you know, it's not a smooth roll through. Life is a roller coaster. Over the last few years, there's been highs and lows all the time. Running that business, there's been times where that business has gone really well. There's times, obviously, we had the whole COVID thing. That business had not had enough books behind it for me to claim any.
Right.
So there wasn't enough support. So I got nothing. Luckily, I had a load of beer still in the bar that was going to go out of date. So I locked myself down in the bar. And had a jolly good time about it.
Crank your way through the problem.
Yeah.
Not the most endorsed way, but
it fluctuates massively.
I came down to the shop a couple of months ago with the Project Pit Stop team to do a little talk, which was great fun.
Yeah.
And amazing that you're supporting them and giving them the space to.
And they obviously shift around venues as well. So they move to different venues and do that. And I think it's a really valuable thing. Obviously, that's supported by Movember.
And it was a great evening being able to talk and share sort of my experiences with them. But then you messaged me afterwards if you're okay to talk about that.
Because
it just struck me that actually it was one of the more powerful things that I've heard in a while, just because of its banality in many respects, because of essentially what you said was, actually, I'm finding it harder now, you know, being a single dad with a business and responsibilities and people, I'm finding that harder at times than the military, my past career ever was.
Yeah, absolutely.
For what we do a lot of, and especially maybe over the last 5-6 years, is the special forces have kind of come out from the shadows, mm-hmm. like yeah. people like yourself and Foxy and Ollie and all the guys have, you know, they've written books. I guess Chris Ryan was kind of the trailblazer, like yeah. lifting the veil on this secret service. Like, and there's, you know, SAS Who Dares Wins, and like, if you want to know about the special forces, there's plenty of people that have been in it that will tell you about
yeah.
it. So our perception now is, you know, whereas these you guys used to be these secret, like, you know, all we ever saw was masked figures jumping through embassies, or you didn't see it, but you just heard about them.
Yeah.
This mythical human, like the pinnacle of masculinity and like the pointy edge of the armed forces, keeping us all safe, all the rest of it, doing things that we can't even comprehend. Now we kind of see you, and that's even more sort of because you're all good looking, fit, athletic guys, that kind of reinforces
that's
the stigma.
That's one of the selection criteria, yeah, is yeah, being very good looking. Yeah, yeah.
You're ugly.
You must be handsome.
That's right up there.
First stop was surgeons before you do selection.
But the point is, you've everything that you were taught to do, all of the experiences you've had, you know, at the extreme of anyone's comprehension, the pressure that you've had to operate under, the physical stress in your life from a professional career point of view, to actually hear that that is nothing compared to being a dad, right? Yeah. Just being a single father. There'd be loads of people out there listening to this going, fuck, yeah, being a single dad is tough,
yeah.
right? Being a dad's tough, yeah. single or otherwise. You know, running a business is tough. You know, life is stressful. You don't have to be getting shot at or jumping out of things
yeah, absolutely.
For life to be stressful and to be struggling and actually to find it more stressful than...
And that's a really good point, is when I was doing that stuff previously, I was free, single, in a mindset. That's all I was focused on. And actually it came very easily, you know, because that's all I was doing. Coming into sort of quite an alien environment of me when I came out and I was... then trying to build a business, do all that, that's quite stressful in itself, and trying to find my way there. And of course, then subsequently, I ended up becoming a dad, and I'm now looking after my little girl now. So I have her and running a business and doing everything else as well. So I'm spinning plates. And luckily, I've got a lot of good people around me that are helping me out. Billy's got her today,
yeah.
So I can come here and chat to you guys and get some of those motorcycles, which is good of him. So doing all that, and it's actually much more stressful.
Is that Billy who was the one said who I think he's probably dead? Is
oh this... no, that was Shane.
That was Shane.
Yeah.
Okay.
Billy.
I was thinking. Don't think you should have left him with Shane. I'm just thinking, you know, as much as
how's
like
my
a
daughter
really
doing?
Nice guy.
Oh, she's probably dead. I haven't seen what I haven't seen her all day.
yeah.
What Shane?
What? But you know, you come from the military. You've got the whole military. As backup, essentially it's a bit like being an actor. When I was acting, you're told where to go, you're told what to do, you're told the mission, you're told thing, and you go and you do it.
Yeah.
And you don't think about the hundreds of other people who are helping you.
Yeah. Thankfully, I've got a lovely lass called Katie, who's working in there now, who runs the cafe and the bar for me, because I was spread so thinly across the ground because we're filming Speed Shop, trying to run a bar, a cafe, bikes. I couldn't do it all. I physically couldn't do it all.
Well, the thing is, so if you do so many things, you can't. You can do each one of those fantastically, individually. But if you're trying to do them all at the same time, you're not doing them all great.
No,
isn't it the most wonderful thing in the world when you finally someone says to you, you've got to get some help, and you're yeah, I can't afford that, and then you finally do get someone, and then you realize that your productivity goes up and you're able to breathe.
Yeah, it's that admitting the fact that you need some help, to be fair, isn't it? You know, but one of the things I've certainly embraced with having my daughter and stuff like that is I'm beginning to unlearn my military mindset. There's stuff that's been pounded into me of how to suppress all my emotions, compartmentalize things, as we spoke about before. She is fantastic for me to be able to begin to break down these walls that I built up for so long. And I'm sure my ex-girlfriend will testify to this, that I'd built up huge walls in order to protect myself, really. It's very hard to
realize it.
Yes, without realizing it, because this is what my job required. And actually, as a general sort of human being coming out into the world, you're a different breed. And what we consider to be normal is far from normal for Civvy Street and the people that we're then interacting with. So yeah, it's been a really interesting process beginning to break that down. I'm by no means been through it. It's still going.
There's just an innocence and a simplicity of thinking.
Yeah, do you know what?
Kids feel.
Yeah,
kids feel. They don't think.
Yeah.
They feel emotion and they project their feelings without thinking about them, don't they?
Yeah. But people have to grow up a little bit when they have children, don't they? Because you're suddenly responsible.
Let's hope Shane has.
Shane's got about four kids.
That doesn't surprise me. Shane seems like the kind
he's
of guy
a great
gonna...
dad. Yeah, yeah.
Probably all.
But there, yeah, I'm guessing your daughter's one of the best therapies you've.
Oh, she's fantastic. And previously I would never have talked about this, but the ability to feel love. Now, I can honestly tell you that while I was in that and I'd built myself up to a point where I was quite devoid of emotion, because I had to be, because of what we were required to do, and we had to deliver an action very, very quickly and then come straight out of it and we'll put to bed whatever happened there, that's done. You become a very callous soul. You know, and then to come out and have to try and unlearn this, she is as you said, Ben. She will be like, I love you. I'm beginning to feel that pang of affection and love for her, which I genuinely wouldn't have thought I could feel previously, and I deny because you're denying yourself.
Feeling.
You cannot allow yourself to be vulnerable like that. But now I can,
Do you find that liberating now?
Yeah, yeah.
Do you find it?
That's the word.
Does it become easier and easier as you're going along?
It's becoming better. And initially, I remember when she was first sort of born, to try and feel love for her was quite difficult because I was just this very standoffish individual. And now, God, she's melting me quicker and quicker, which is great. It's like the reverse of a snowball effect. Gradually it's just shrinking and shrinking and it's just great. And I'm enjoying it.
That must be so enjoyable for you as well, because one, you can be as close as you want to her, you can be as open, and that goes into business, into friendships, into people, into everything.
Yeah, absolutely. It's beneficial across the board. I'm enjoying the process. It's great, and I feel a lot better for it.
That's great. Yeah. I think it's really interesting because it doesn't take long to learn certain behaviours and to deal with things. You know, you had 20 plus years of being taught or drilled and assimilated into a certain way of thinking, behaving and acting. That's a long time to unlearn. But actually, I think you can get into these mindsets actually frighteningly quickly. I think for me, when I had chemo for 4 months, when I second diagnosis of cancer, I went into this super combative. I've talked to Foxy about this. I was like, you know, you've had real bullets shot at you and you've got to cope, and you're like, right, I'm either just going to stand still and get shot or I'm going to fight. And I had like cancer bullets fired at me in the form of chemo. It's like, well, you either just take it, stand still and get shot, or you fight like fuck. And that was my mindset. So I very quickly got into this full on, just fight everything. I've got to fight chemo, I'm fighting cancer, I'm going to fight chemo, I've got to get through it. I've got this period to get through and I'm just going to attack it. Tell me what I've got to do or just do it. And at no point, and it took years actually and some counselling, because after I had the chemo and got the all clear, I was still in that mindset. And it's so quickly, within 4 months or so, I got into this fight everything, compete at everything, take everything on mindset that I didn't have to anymore, but I was still doing it. And that became quite destructive. I wouldn't let people go past me. Because I was like, fight that. And I'd like, just had to prove I was all right.
This just keep going. A lot.
Yeah. So, I've tried to ease the back on that now, because you're the same. What? But that was like, that was 4 or 5 months to get into that destructive mindset where I, at no point, and it was only through counselling that my counsellor said, have you ever congratulated yourself? I was like, for what? It's like, for winning. You beat cancer, you survived. Like, you got through it. You don't have to fight anymore. You're done. I was like, oh, fuck. Yeah. No, I haven't. That seemed weird. But now you've said it, actually. Yeah, I don't need to fight everything and everyone anymore. Pick your fights.
Yeah, pick your fights. Yeah. You don't need to do that.
And I'm, yeah. But that's, it's, like I say, it doesn't take long to learn that behavior. But when you've been doing it for 20 years, that's a lot more unpicking to work through. But, you know, having kids and stuff, it's
picking up habits is as easy, isn't it? Getting rid of habits. It took me ages to get rid of stop sucking my thumb.
Yeah.
It just took me ages.
But
how are you getting on?
but it is. I think people should congratulate themselves a little bit more, really.
But it's really hard in life to, I do it all the time, going back to like when I have a dark day or I'm not feeling great or I don't want to get out of bed. You focus on things you don't have and you just completely forget about the things you do have and the things that you have accomplished. Like so many days I go, oh shit, I wish this and I wish I had this and I wish I could do this and why can't I get this? And I think, I've had a fucking privileged life. I've had so much luck and so much grit, like doing the TV and having my shop and building my own business and being able to do something I love to do every day. And I don't have to get up and do a normal job. Like, I don't even know what a fucking normal job would be like. You know what I mean? But like, still to this day, I don't think I've actually ever kind of congratulated myself on doing all the great things that I've done thus far in my life. You know what I mean? I'm 47 and for the last, I don't know, 20 years of my life, I haven't had a job per se. You know what I mean? I've had,
That's what he tells the tax man. Yeah.
Sometimes you just have to kind of step back and go, you know what? You know, life's been really good.
Talking about it is one of the keys, like with all of this stuff. It's very hard to get perspective from introspection because you, like you say, you get caught up in your own head, your own voice and looking. And sometimes it's very hard to step back from that and give yourself that perspective and actually reflect. And unless you put those structures in place to help you do that. But talking to other people instantly, like you've just done it.
Yeah.
By saying it out loud, you've just done it.
Yeah.
Because you've had to explain to somebody else, I'm stuck and I don't get to do this. But you've just said it. You've just taken that time to stop and congratulate yourself.
But so for you, you know, you've got your daughter, you've got your business, you've been successful on television.
He's got his looks.
He's got his looks on it, but that's not
good. The long hair was good. Yeah, that was good.
It used to be longer, and the mustache as well. It's a bit of facial.
It looks like D'Artagnan. He looks like a musketeer, doesn't he?
D'Artagnan,
The Muskerhounds. I didn't want to give him too many compliments. He looks like D'Artagnan.
The Muskerhounds.
We're the Muskerhounds. Yeah.
So what's for you know, in the immediate future?
I'm doing a lot of security. I've just come back from Monaco Grand Prix. I was working over there.
That didn't look like a particularly tough gig, mate, if I'm honest. That's sort of security I could have done.
I was making it look easy.
Oh, okay.
It's very hard. No, it's
standing on a yacht.
It's fantastic. Prime location, bang, on the track.
And what about television and stuff like that?
Well, we've got this program called Saved and Remade, which is, it's a bit like Repair Shop. If you've seen that, that's just, but I always think it's a little bit harder than Repair Shop, to be fair, because Repair Shop, they bring in a broken banjo and they bring in the banjo repairman and he comes in with his banjo repair kit and repairs it. Whereas Saved and Remade, people bring in a banjo and say, well, this is my great granddad's. It's been sat in the attic for ages. I would like you to turn it into something that I can use in the house. In the kitchen,
firewood,
and you make it into a ladle or something. So actually, you've got to really use the grey matter and try and think of some interesting ideas for it.
And that's where your engineering comes in.
Yeah, and I always tend to get given everybody on the show is very, very talented, apart from myself. I'm just a guy who twiddles around and builds bikes and stuff like that. There's a fantastic guy on there, Lee Dyer, who's calls himself a blacksmith. He's a metal sculptor. This guy can create fantastic sculptures out of steel. His bread is amazing. And I tend to get the things nobody else wants. Can you do something? No, nobody's got any ideas. Right, Titch, you're going to do something with that. And I'm like... And it is really interesting to do something that's totally outside your comfort zone and give it a go.
And then you give it back to them.
And they go, Has anybody just... That's amazing.
You've ruined my grandfather's ukulele.
I thought this was the repair shop. What have you done?
What is that? I thought you were going to fix it.
Have you ever had that situation where they were upset with what you guys have done to their stuff?
There has been... Yeah, there have been some people who were a little bit miffed.
Where can people find the show? Is it on at the moment?
It's on like Channel Really, which is where all those platform. It's like all those sort of repair shop, Saved and Remade, all that sort of stuff.
Oh, nice.
So it's nice to be able to sort of dip my toe in and out, and still really keen to sort of do things with Speed Shop. Been chatting to another channel who seemed to be quite interested.
You've got to figure out what the beat of the audience
what they want
changes all the time.
I'd love to do things like military history. I've got loads of really interesting ideas to do stuff with military history and then bringing in the vehicles and stuff like that. Build those vehicles, test it out, actually go and almost do what they did. And talk about, because I think the thing is, I can then put a spin on it and give my perspective from what these guys were achieving back in the day, these guys and girls doing, and go, hang on a minute, right, they were going to do this. You would never dream of doing that in modern day warfare. This would be absolutely ludicrous, but they decided they were going to do it.
When you start making that show, do one about my granddad, because he was a tanky. Right. He came off the beaches and then went back and D-Day. So he was off and on, in his tank. So that was pretty cool. My other grandfather was sunk. He was a submariner. He got sunk in the Thames by a Dutch trawler after the war. Ruined his career.
After the war?
Yeah, after the war, yeah. They were on a training exercise and a Dutch trawler hit them and sank it, and he lost most of his crew. He was captain.
That's horrific.
And they spent the rest of his life behind a desk until he then went to work for Plessy and basically installed radar in the Middle East, in Iraq and Syria.
That's random, isn't
it? Yeah, that was his job. He went out and he was the sort of lead man in selling radar.
And if you want some misspent SAS, expertise that I never used, should have been,
honestly, there's another show for that, and I'll speak to Foxy, we'll get you signed up for SAS Who Dares Wins. You can go on the show and prove to everyone you could have made selection.
What are you going to do when they dangle you by the testicles off a cliff?
And I'm 47. My nuts stretch far and long these days.
Excellent. You can touch the floor.
It's almost like bungee jumping for me at this point.
I want to know what's going to happen when day one, minute one, somebody stands in front of you, tells you what to do, and shouts in your face.
Go fuck yourself.
Right.
Go on, mama.
You know, they do that selection before they get to the TV show. All right. Anyway,
put me forward.
I'm just saying that it always amazes me some of the characters that they let through. I mean, obviously, I think they let them through.
They have for entertainment purposes only,
don't they? Because you're like, what are you?
It's the same for MasterChef, and they can't cook, but they're quite good value.
I think it'd be great if you got all the really good ones, because it would get absolutely horrific until they dropped out.
It's like if selection was easy, what would be the point?
Just get the characters in. He's gonna be great if you went out for a beer with him. He can pass.
He's all right. Last thing I want to ask you very quickly, what piqued my interest was the Royal Navy, Royal Marines road race team.
Yeah.
Road race, motorcycle road racing.
It's closed circuit racing. I got sort of poached onto the team because I was riding motocross and enduro. And one of the guys that they worked with in the motor transport department was a driver called Billy Callister. And Billy used to race TT. So he was one of the Royal Marines riders for the TT and stuff like that. So he raced on closed circuit and roads. And he constantly been badgering me about joining the Royal Navy Royal Marines road race team. And eventually I was like, yeah, sure, let's give it a go. So I ended up riding for them, and I was riding in Thundersport in the 600s. I could ride a bike at this point, I was pretty handy. But when I first went out there on Thundersport and started riding in, it was like I'd just bought a bike with a reverse on
it.
I had no comprehension how fast those boys were riding.
When you did the start of your first race, and then everybody went past you before you even got the clutch out.
What I found was that I was starting at the back anyway, you know, with my little Lumi vest on, and I was off away from the start. But I remember being lapped in about three laps, four laps. And I was thinking I was on the ragged edge, and there was guys under me, over me, you know, that, coming past me at a rapid rate of knots, and I didn't know what to do with myself, really. It took me about half a season to start latching on the back of the pack, and then it took me about a good two seasons to start getting up there and just to learn the pace to ride at. And
it's the consistency, isn't it? You know what I mean? Because like, you can have a great lap, and then you have a couple shit laps, and then you have a great lap, and but the guys that have been doing it for ages, it's the consistency. You might be a better rider, but it's having that knowledge and that, you know, keeping the pace.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's great pace as well. How much speed you can go into the corners
to throw it in,
you know, and how much you rely on that front wheel. It's
trail breaking, learning the art of trail breaking is a whole art of itself. You know.
So
what I mean?
What was your best result?
I've had top tens and stuff like that in the 600. So I went from the 600 novices to then 600 elites and had some top tens and stuff like that. Cool. So I was quite happy with that. You know, I was going all right. One thing I wish I had really got fired into was the CB 500 Cup. Some of the best racing going, because it's so strict on the rules and regs. Everyone's on the same tyres. Yeah. You're not allowed to touch the engine. It's the same bike. It's a bit like Moto 3, you know, when you've just got a swarm of people all going round in this big group. And this is where people like Rory Skinner now and stuff like that, they were racing in Thundersport back then, and they started off all in there, and then the Prettier Super Teens, and now crikey, he's doing some MotoGP rides and stuff.
He's riding Moto 2
he's on the American team.
Yeah,
he's doing for his first season.
Old John Hopkins team.
Well, thank you.
Well, thank you guys. That was great. You. I really enjoyed that.
It was a good day.
Yeah, it's been a good day.
Yeah. Been a really been a fun day. Day. Great bikes.
Great chat.
They have really good bikes, actually. We can't wait. There's rumours of a track day on them that we're going to
off we go.
And hopefully there'll be petrol in the bikes.
Yes.
To get a
that strange
go.
Fluid that makes them go forward.
Yeah. Had a rapid night. Great. Well, Titch, thanks so much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much.
To have you on. Yeah. Thanks for coming along today.
That was great.
I hope you've enjoyed another episode this week. It's been a lot of fun, actually.
I've enjoyed it. Loved it.
Do make sure you subscribe, get your alerts, and then rate and share the show to help us grow. You can follow us as ever on Instagram at The Nod Pod. And as always, a big thanks to our sponsors and friends at the British Motorcycle Insurance Community. Check them out at thebmic.co.uk and join the community. We'll be back next week with another guest. Oh, I think next week, actually, it's a couple of guests. We're doing a bit of a double up. It's going to be a slight break from the norm. We're doing something a little bit different.
Pod swap.
That's probably the name of it. We're going to do a pod swap. We'll see you there for that. In the meantime, stay safe, be kind, and check in with a mate.